Welcome to Spaghetti Launchers, the world building podcast where we throw spaghetti at the wall and it is up to you what sticks. I'm Kyle.
I'm Ethan. Today's episode, we'll be discussing The Witcher in one of our takeout episodes. Fuck.
That fuck actually sounded pretty much like Carol. That was pretty good. All right. Well, yeah, that's his best impression of Geralt of Rivia.
Fuck.
The Witcher series. We're doing
a takeout episode.
Yeah, about the whole IP. So because there are multiple things. You know, you have three games. You have a bunch of books. You have
soon to be a fourth game.
Yes, eventually there'll be a fourth game.
I haven't read the books nor watched the TV show. Couldn't get in. They made decisions.
Yes. I heard. Yeah. We're not going to break down that. The internet's full of hate videos against The Witcher. So if you want to go watch people eviscerate that show.
The Witcher TV show. Yeah,
the TV show. People are doing that. But I know you were a big fan of the animated TV show that they had, right?
They made a movie, and I like Studio Mir's design. I just like their character and their graphic design. But the movie itself was ironically called Nightmare of the Wolf. It was a fucking nightmare. It just didn't work. Nah.
All right. Well,
nah,
I think
not so much.
No matter how you slice it, the video games and the core books are fantastic and well regarded, and the world building that he pulls off, Andrzej Sapkowski. His world building is great and interesting, and it's, you know, there's plenty of it that's not overly, you know, unique, but it all comes together in a way that makes it work.
Well, he strikes a really grounded tone. And
yeah.
I think that's very important, is that there is
And his
so
themes
much,
are really good.
It's it what?
His themes are really good.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially if the themes about like monsters and like humans are the monsters of all
lowercase M monsters versus capital M monsters, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
I think that keeps it very grounded, because the best stories are all going to be about person-to-person interaction anyway.
Yeah.
So this really just gets at the core of that, and then makes it easy to say, hey, these monsters are just, we got to kill them, without making it too complicated, right? You know, it sidesteps a lot of the debate, you know, the are monsters people debate that's happening in D&D and gaming spaces.
Yeah, well, they're not sentient.
You're not sentient. Always. The humans are the main monsters. So yet you get that complexity, and you can still have the fun of monster hunters.
Yeah.
Which is really cool to be able to do, and threads that needle really well. And in doing so, I think actually, I was reading an article, not an article, I was reading a Reddit thread about this earlier this week, that was trying to figure out what the hell is going on with the D&D Ranger. Why can't anybody figure it out? What's trying to happen? What is the actual archetype of the Ranger? They couldn't decide, like, is it more Legolas or it's Aragorn? And someone responded under it saying, it's Geralt. Hmm. When people think of a ranger, the modern archetype of the ranger is probably Geralt of Rivia.
Interesting.
Which I thought was kind of cool. Like, you're out in the wilds, you're hunting monsters, you've got your senses,
bows be damned. Now it's the monster hunter.
It's the monster hunter, yeah.
And, you know, like the charismatic in his own way, like gruff monster hunter, very like socially awkward, but you know,
way more comfortable in the wilds than with people. I was like, that it hadn't occurred to me, but I think there's a point there.
Yeah, so let's sink our teeth in the world building a bit. And I think the main thing that I love about this world building is the way that, like, you got to like the grounded tone. I think a lot of that groundedness also comes from the fact that the world building and the history of it is incredibly in depth, but not in your face, and it's all still relevant. Like, specifically the politics, and there's like in the continent where it takes place, there's so many kingdoms, and they're all characterized in their own way, and they're not necessarily like in your face of like, here's like all of the, we have Gondor and Rohan, and they're so different in the way that they dress and whatever. Like, you know,
they're not planets of hats.
Yeah, they're not planets of hats, and their politicking is so in depth, and they have spy networks and like intelligence services. Like, they have all these kings and queens and all the intermarrying and the politics, and it's very much, you can tell this man is Polish and he studied Central European history a lot, because there's so many. It's these small kingdoms,
yeah,
and the way that it's the way
and
that
baronies
and the way that it's alive. Yeah, it's a good point. Like, And I think that goes so long because it's never the story itself necessarily, but it's always a backdrop that makes every character feel like they have a just a little bit more of an edge to them. Mm-hmm. There's just something more there rather than saying they are from Planet of Hat 1 and they're from Planet of Hat 2. It's like, no, well, this is like this country hates this country for this really specific reason that you can trace back 30 years to a war that just happened.
Mm-hmm. It's all that. The history is not ancient. The history is recent enough.
Yes.
That the trauma is still real for people. The politics are still impacted by it, but it is not so recent as to feel raw still. It's all, you know, I mean, if you think what was happening 30 years ago and the way in the United States we talk about the war in Iraq, like we are still very much impacted by it.
Yeah.
That was 20 years ago, but I think
I thought you were saying Desert Storm. I was like, that's 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah. That too. But Desert Storm, even better. Case in point, right? Yeah. Desert Storm was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it is still very much impacting global policy and American foreign policy today, but it is not the thing.
We don't talk about it daily.
In the same way. Yeah. And it feels very similar.
And I think what they do that I really like, because it is a part of the story with the destruction of Syntra, which mm-hmm. happens in the stories, and they portray it, I think, pretty decently in the show. That is an important note in the global history, and it gets to be a part of the living world story that's happening. Because, like, you know, the Witcher is told through anthology and through short stories, so you get to hop around a bit more. We have one singular overarching story, but that being in there is awesome, because mm-hmm. everybody who's ever world built, who likes kingdoms and politics and all that shit, always wants to have like the kingdom that gets swallowed and have that be a historical thing, or have that be an active conflict that's going on, and he places it just right to have it have just happened and have it still be important that happened, but not be everywhere.
I know you haven't watched it. The other media that does this really well is Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood.
Okay.
Just plugging it, because it is the way that the politics of war are handled and being in a post-war world is masterfully done there.
Yeah.
So if folks are looking for other examples of this, I would go recommend watching that.
Yeah. So whenever you're looking at the world building of The Witcher, what do you think people at home should take away and try to apply elsewhere? What takeout are you truly ordering here? What ideas come to you?
It's a hard one to describe, so bear with me.
Okay. But
there's something in the language that makes the world incredibly accessible. The way that people are named, the way that things are titled, the names of kingdoms, they are all grounded in real world language enough to feel very real and intelligible. And by intelligible, I mean like understandable and graspable without feeling like you're learning another language, but they still sound just fantastical enough as to feel sort of otherworldly and different. And I think that's really, really important, because it's one of the many things that keeps it grounded in the world without sounding overly written like so much of fantasy can.
Yeah.
There's no one, you know.
There's no crazy apostrophes.
Right. There's no Archon Drakthir, the black dragon slayer. You know, it's just not there, right?
Why you throw my boy Archon Drakthir, the black dragon slayer, underneath the bus? He's a great dude. I think that's a really good point. Like Nilfgaard, the main evil empire, has a name that's on one hand a little funny and a little silly, but also graspable and fantastical. Syntra, the one I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
That's a great name for a kingdom.
Yeah.
And it's super easy to say. And it makes sense.
And it's a wonderful example of the balancing act, right? If you go... Let's use Tolkien as an example, right? And create your own whole conlang for it. And then you start naming worlds without any grounding in a real world language. It feels very alien and fantastical. And it's one of the tenets of high fantasy, but it can also be harder to grasp. Versus if you try and use only English words or grounded existing human world words, it can start sounding silly where you have to, you're making up
and
words
to be fair,
for everything all the time, you know, and you're doing that fantasy thing where you're combining words, and
this might be aided by the fact that they're written in Polish.
It might be, but that might be my point then is
so if you're listening, you should write in Polish, or a different language than English, and then have it translated to English, and then you're golden.
And then you're...
But, I mean, it's a common thing I think you and I have both used, and anybody who's listened to this podcast has probably done this, is you just fucking translate shit. You go
all the time.
You go to other languages, and you translate words, and you use other words as the base of... You use other languages as the base of what you name. Like, in The Witcher, Skellige is the most fucking...
Skellige is great.
It's so Scandi. That's the most Scandi word you could come up with.
Yeah.
It, like, Toussaint. Like, it's just fully France.
Absolutely. Part of the lesson here is really just to embrace. Don't put too much pressure on yourself to make things hyper fantastical or hyper realistic, but embrace some element of realism here. You know, for example, let's talk The Wild Hunt, right?
Okay.
The Wild Hunt is a mythological concept from Germanic history. It is in Norse history. It was originally theoretically supposedly led by Odin, and has existed throughout all time. So it's a concept that feels very familiar to a lot of people, even if they don't necessarily realize it.
Yeah, and but especially for a Polish audience,
especially for a Polish audience,
it'd probably be familiar,
right? So for them to change that and tweak it a little bit and turn it into, oh, this thing exists because it is this basically pirate ship of elves that's traveling interdimensionally to gather slaves for their former master. Like, that's sure. Okay.
Yeah.
I get that. Not only does that have does that feel like very grounded and something that humans would actually come up with.
Yeah.
But it is also a great motivation for a villain, because it is not take over the world. It is not destroy everything. It's, no, we're lazy. Our masters are lazy. We just need slaves. So we're just going to do that until they find out about Ciri. And then they, you know, that changes everything.
Yeah.
But I thought that was a great example of how do you, number one, keep things grounded, but also flesh it out to fit it into your world a little bit, or fit it into a different world.
Yeah. So then how do you... So premise of these Take It episodes, how would we take The Wild Hunt and
well, so
what idea do we extract out of that? Is it having a interdimensional pirate ship of slavers?
I mean, yes, I think that's dope, but
you
also
could do
see Gith Yankee.
Good point.
Where I would take an idea like this, or how I would use this, is to look at the Dullahan. So the Dullahan is a creature out of Irish mythology. I might be thinking of the wrong one. I forget which one. But it is also the origin of both the Jack-O-Lantern and the Headless Horseman.
Yeah.
And so for me, what I would do is think of a creature that walks around with its own head in one hand. And then famously, the Dullahan also used, I think it used its own spine as a sword.
I don't like that.
Or as a weapon in the other one. And I would use that, because even if you, like, yes, that would be immediately zombie, but if you were to, it would also evoke Headless Horseman. It would evoke, if you had its eyes flaming, it would evoke Jack-O-Lantern, right? There are ways that you can overlap cultural imagery to create something new by going back to and playing around with the roots of a thing. So that's where I would do, is come up with this headless knight and maybe turn it into, hey, this is the type of warrior... This is a type of soldier
for this Wild Hunt like entity
that only a necromancer or something can create.
So there's like a whole squad. There's like the Ringwraith style situation where it's like there's this group of headless horsemen carrying around a spine whip of their, you know, and they are doing whatever they're doing, interdimensional slave trading or whatever.
Or just trying to find their own heads.
Could be
It. They're just trying to get on to move on to the rest of their lives.
So, you know,
afterlives.
You know, that's interesting. When you brought the Wild Hunt, I'm thinking about the fact that, like, in the Witcher, Geralt basically sacrifices himself to get Yennefer out of the clutches of the Wild Hunt and says, I will, like,
Yennefer is here.
Yennefer.
Yennefer.
And so he gives up 5 years of his life, basically, to
He joins them.
Yeah, he joins
them. That's right. That, which is another great point. I'd forgotten that part. Yes, that's even better. Have a character be part of your bad guys.
Yes. But
thank you. I had totally forgotten about that.
You completely just thunderstole my point.
Yeah.
So he joins in the stead of Yennefer and sacrifices 5 years of his life, loses his memory on the tail end of that. And that's where you begin. And the idea that you would have this bad guy group, these Wild Hunt characters who you can essentially or who are seeking super capable warriors to join them, and they can do it on a limited service contract, basically. So like, you can come in for X period of time and then we'll release you and we will wipe your memory of that time and you have amnesia, but like whatever trouble you were in is now gone.
Yeah.
So say you have Geralt had been arrested and was going to be executed. Wild Hunt will just break into his prison cell through an interdimensional means and say, you can be executed or you can work for us for 5 years and then we'll dump you somewhere else in this other world and you'll be free.
Yeah, sort of very, very much in the same veins of, you can take the Black, or even weirdly the Sadokar from Dune, where they're plucked from Seleucus Secundus.
There you go. So, yeah, like...
Yeah.
Deploying that mechanism of the joining them anywhere.
Yeah, I'd totally forgotten about that part of it, and that is a very, very good point. Yeah. And probably I think the more interesting one beyond even the one, I mean, I do think the Dullahan is dope, but even beyond that, plus they also sail, their ship is made out of the teeth and fingers and toenails of deceased people, and I think that's pretty great. So
yeah, we know.
Yeah.
You've City of Teeth.
If you have a city of teeth, why wouldn't you have ships of teeth? It just makes
sense. Fleshies.
The ability to join and then leave or have to seek your freedom from, I think, is very, very, very good and very interesting.
Yeah. So other ideas that are swimming around my brain while looking at The Witcher's world building, everybody who has listened to this podcast for some length of time probably knows I really love the Lodge of Sorcerers.
No, you've never mentioned them before.
I know. I think I love a cabal. I love a fictional cabal. I love a cabal in my fantasy. I think it works. And I think they do a great job of deploying it in a way that feels realistic, in that there are cross-cutting cleavages within this cabal, and they are not all on the same page at any given point. They're all assigned to different courts, basically. So a sorceress is assigned to every single court in the land, and they all have communication with each other, and some of them are trusted, some of them are like, well, I have a good alliance with this one, and this one I don't trust her, yada yada. Great internal politics, great positioning in the world, and makes the whole world's politics far more interesting, because now you have this background group who is influencing them, and then they're influencing global politics by Philippa and I don't get along, and she's trying to get this kingdom to come at me, and we yada yada, and that all works so well.
All the conflict is very human.
It's very human. So that, but I'm confused. Why exactly wouldn't all these kingdoms also bring into their court a fucking witcher and just have a witcher be on staff? You are often paying them. People are paying them to deal with monsters that are wrecking your people and your farmlands and towns and villages. Why don't you hire one or two or a little squad and have them be government officials, and then they take care of this business for you, full stop. And beyond the world of The Witcher, I think you could just deploy this in any story where you have a monster hunter be on staff at a court. Courts have, sometimes they'll have a beastmaster or something, but they never have a monster hunter. And if say you're in a D&D game or anything where it's high fantasy and there are lots of monsters in the world, it makes perfect sense that you would be like, well, we could hire adventurers ad hoc, or we could just have a guy on retainer who's really good at this and we trust, and he just takes care of shit. And then people don't come pissed at me because a griffin is running around because, oh, the griffin's already dead, we took care of it. What's up? What, they stupid?
Griffins, notoriously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, where does the Illuminati... Well, Illuminati.
Illuminati.
Where does the Illuminati... Where does the Illuminati party?
I don't know.
At the Cabal? Like a ball? A gala?
Oh. Yeah, we'll leave it in.
B minus. I think for narrative purposes, the reason they do it is because our point of view character is obviously needs to be mobile.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But narrative-wise, I get it.
Narrative-wise, I get it. Practically, I'm with you. This is also, not to talk about work, but bringing up a conversation that, you know, conversations that we're having about, oh, shared services versus, you know, hub and spoke organizational models. Why are we specializing in anything when we can just outsource anything? Like, the real talk, there might just be the amount of resources that it takes to create and generate one Witcher might be too much for a kingdom to bear the burden of. And maybe it's only these specialized sages that can do it and know how to do it. And if they refuse to sign, which I think is probably what happened in the world, then yeah, they would be not able to have that there. I mean, the trial of the grasses, which is one of the other ideas I wanted to talk about, takes 2 weeks and I think over half of the people that take it die, and requires very
more than that. It's a high percentage.
It's like 60 or 75% of the people that go through it die. I mean, it is an incredibly resource intensive process.
In the world of The Witcher, absolutely. Because like the Witchers are critical and they make a lot of sense. But I think is like an idea that you could extract elsewhere. You don't need to do a trial of the grass. You don't need to have people be on mutagens.
Sure.
You can just have a really good, you could have just a ranger.
Yeah.
A Geralt style ranger,
yeah,
aka a regular ranger now, and just have them take care of it. That it, like, outside of The Witcher, I think within The Witcher, if we're playing around with the world building in The Witcher, yeah, like that, it is cumbersome because of what you just said, and I think there's probably like a sense of independence, like a fierce independence, but the Lodge also has their own independence in their own way. So, like, you know, The Witchers could also, and there aren't many sorceresses.
There aren't. It's true. So, which makes seeing one especially momentous.
Same with the Witchers.
That's my, yeah, I'm agreeing.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, I mean, remember
the Titans.
The awe when Benjen Stark came into the room in Winterfell in the beginning. They're like, oh, they're one of the Rangers of the North. Like, oh, these mysterious people.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Every story loves that moment. You love the mysterious stranger, the badass. Everyone's like...
Real. But yeah, no, it was the same when you first meet Strider before you knew it was Aragorn.
Yeah.
You're like, who the fuck is this dude?
Yeah, and the Witchers can give off that vibe. But but I'm sorry, you wanted to get more into the Trial of the Grasses.
No, the Trial of the Grasses is just, you know, I love an initiation ritual.
So you want to take an initiation ritual and just that's really fucking difficult and cause people die and apply that elsewhere.
Correct.
You just want to kill people.
Yeah.
And I think having a rough initiation ritual like that honestly makes sense in contexts where like you're being infused with magic.
I think it absolutely does.
Here's how you could take it. Why is it that... Okay, let's go with like a somewhat like cosmic-y horror D&D type like thing. You have warlocks making a pact with a collective Cthulhu type creature. And to make that to join into this collective pact, you have to go through some trial.
I agree.
And that trial will test your brain and you might go insane and you might die.
Or I think you can, if you want to take it more broadly, there should always be a price to power. So
true.
I always think of... sticking with the warlocks, I always imagine a warlock as slowly the higher level they are, the more they start to resemble their patron physically. So like if you're an archfey warlock, you slowly over time start looking like a crazy fucking elf or fey creature.
Okay.
Right. If you're a great old one, you might start getting some yellow eyes and have some squiggly appendages coming from places.
Yeah, I like that.
You know, like what over time, but I think that has to be part of it, right? If you're a sorcerer, you know, you're burning through your life a little bit faster. I think that's how you take it big. But
so say you do a trial of the grasses type thing.
Yeah.
You do an intense initiation ritual. to be a great old one or whatever. You have to like consume some great old one essence, ether, blah, something.
Ichor.
And then, ichor.
Pus.
Ichor's the word. Beautiful word.
Bile.
Nope. We're sticking with ichor. Ichor's fantastic. And you consume the ichor, and then you...
Semen.
Oh, fuck you. Why did you pick that?
Because I'm making direct eye contact with you, and I wanted to see your reaction.
It was a reaction. So you consume this semen, and then... I'm sorry. You consume this ichor, and then... You start growing the like little appendages like as a result of the trial. Yeah. Like you come out of that trial and it's literally like, you could go blind if your eyes can't turn in this new color, if your bone structure can't handle like a change to make a squiggly appendage come out, you're going to lose an arm.
Right. And, or it'll break or become useless, or you're just being constant physical pain.
And if you fail the trial, if you fail some part of the trial and say you go blind or your arm is crippled, they will just kill you. Just say you failed.
Mm-hmm. You're done.
Like, even if
I love it.
Like you physically didn't die, you did not pass.
Yep.
So we're going to take you out.
I love it. I think the other part that I found really interesting about it is that this is all, you know, what we would call herbalism that they have realized is science. And so looking back, there is so...
It's real, the RFK Jr. School of Science.
Basically. But there, I mean, look, acupuncture has been around for thousands of years. Yoga, yep. Meditation. We are now only starting to discover the actual physical science behind all of these practices that people have known have benefits for thousands of years. They haven't been able to exactly quantify what they are or why they work, but they know that they exist.
Yeah.
And so it has been, I think that is some lean into the oldness of it, the traditional healer thing of saying like, nope, this works.
Yeah.
And this is something that you can make. Yeah. Maybe you've got a character who hears about this trial of the grasses and, you know, goes around asking different, you know, wise women what the different herbs are that could make me do this, and they try and put it together on their own and they get the herbs wrong or the mix wrong and they just die. You know, like it's all based in this. And so make it accessible to
the world.
Yeah.
So say you take the trial of the grasses and taking that idea and then be like, okay, well, these are herbs and these are poultices and whatever that exists in the world, you could just, anybody can make them.
Theoretically.
And then just, they might fuck it up.
Right.
Because it's not like this is you need a specific synthetic product that doesn't really exist outside of a lab.
Right.
So you can just go try to harvest this flower in the woods. And if you can get all the right stuff, you can try this at home. And then in the context of like a story, somebody has acquired all of these potions or whatever through this herbalism, they mm-hmm. figured out how to do this, and then they try it at home and they do like one of them and they're like, oh, it's too much, and they stop. So they're like partway witcherified, and that's the character in the party.
Or worse, they get it right
and they become a witcher on their own,
and then suddenly they're like selling it.
Mm.
That's what happened in the Marvel universe, which is kind of boggling my mind that no one's really addressing this, that now there's just super soldier serum out in the world and they cracked and figured out the formula. And I don't, that they're not using that properly in the universe. I don't understand why it isn't everywhere. But yeah, if you imagine it was something, you know, you figured out how to crack the trial of the grasses and maybe how to even improve upon it because all these sages haven't touched it in 1,000 years.
And maybe it's actually should be perfectly safe.
Right. They're just doing it badly.
Or they're doing it with an old, it's that, you know, we're using so many media references today. We're a little bit scattered. But the, like in Scrubs, in Scrubs, when there's that, that sequence where there's, Dick Van Dyke as a doctor
and
he's a much older doctor and he's using out of date practices. Bingo. And Kelso tells him like, you know, like, no, you got to use this new practice. Like they're in conflict.
I can't do it. I'm just
like,
not.
He can't keep up with the changes, but he was advising that JD do an out of date, incredibly dangerous procedure,
mm-hmm. which he still should have theoretically known how to do, but that's not the point.
The point is this isn't the right way to do it now. It's like, we've moved on. And the trial of the grasses could be this ancient procedure that no one has tried to improve. And so it's, the fatality rate is 70%. But if you did this new thing, it'd be 10%.
Right.
People would be living and you would have a lot more witchers. And maybe that's an intentional choice that they don't want too many witchers because they want the money. They want the success. They want the jobs for themselves.
Yeah.
They want the camaraderie. They want the whatever. Like, and it's the culture that's been bred into that. Because if, say you're a new witcher, it's going to be really hard for you to join that club and say, well, we need to fight to get more witchers. We got to change the procedure. They're going to buy into the culture and just say, well, this is the way it is.
Yeah.
So that's how it goes.
Tradition is the dead getting a vote, as one of our old professors used to say.
I think it's as a lot of people say.
Yeah. But it's real.
So moving on to another idea that I want to talk about, it might be the last idea, because I think we're running out of time too.
Yeah.
This is more of a story thing, but it's also a world building piece, is that I love that Ciri is the heir to an empire.
Oh, yeah.
And that Ciri is basically running away from that, but is super capable. So her, like, she's incredibly powerful and dangerous in her own way, and her being on the lam is not like, it's like, oh, there's a helpless maiden out there. It's like, no, you have to go fucking find her and convince her or drag her, but good luck with that. Like, how do you get back this, like, rambunctious heir that does not want to be an heir?
It's real Princess Jasmine.
Yeah. But with, like,
grown up.
And with a sword and magic that can destroy the world.
Sure.
So, like, that's a fucking weird dynamic.
Yeah.
And I love it. And I don't think you need to go as, like, far as Ciri, but having a emperor's child or a king's child or a queen's child, whatever, like, who is out on the run and fully knows what they're giving up, isn't a spoiled child trying to be like, I don't want to be in charge. They're like, I hate this place. I don't want to be in power. I think it's corrupted, and I'd rather go kill monsters and do something, like, to actually help or whatever. It's like, well, fuck, that's, like, an interesting, it's not like a, you know, because you see in so many stories, it's like, oh, the rich kid who's just like wants to run away, and then it's actually because they're just abdicating responsibility and they just want to, like, go drink and party. It's like, Ciri is trying to do the hardest fucking job in the world. Well, maybe being emperor probably be harder because, you know, being an emperor is hard, but depending.
Maybe.
It depends on if you're trying to be a good emperor or stable.
But also, I think for her, it's so different from the Aragorn style, I'm afraid I can't do this. What if I mess up? It's like, no, she's like, no, I could do it.
Yeah.
And that's not the question here.
Yeah. And I mean, Aragorn knew he could do it. You know,
I mean, it was a convention for the movie. It was a creation.
The movie kind of played up the, oh, he's like the humble. He's like, he kind of won.
No. In the books, he won.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. Like,
yeah, but that is like the modern trope is the martyr, is the hero martyr.
I don't want this, like, you know, like, oh, like,
it's I'm too much responsibility.
But Leia, it's like this, like, or like the, you know, oh, those who want power, you know, don't deserve it. So if you don't, so if you are humble and you don't want the power, then it's like, no, she's like, I literally don't want the fucking power. I want to go become a witcher and make myself completely off the edge of the earth. And I might die trying to, because I want to do the witcher trial of the grasses. Like, that level of commitment to not being in power and against everyone else's wishes.
There's a difference between
being pulled back.
Yes, agreed. And there's a difference then between avoiding power and straight up rejecting it.
Yeah. It's not, she's not running from power. She's rejecting it and thus running away from those who are trying to force it upon her.
Correct.
And that is cool. I want that to be replicated in some other way, even on a lower scale, to just say, I'm rejecting your power. Do not, like, you won't accept my no, so I will leave. Because that's key, is that, like, nobody's accepting her being like, I don't want to figure it out without me.
What would you do to have there be someone, to have them still be dependent on that person? Why couldn't the law be changed? Is there something, are they a magical person, right? Yeah. If they're really rejecting it, and they're, imagine the number of resources that that Amir probably expended trying to find Ciri. Now, Ciri had the Elder Blood thing, so it sort of made sense, but it's...
Yeah, he wants her for a specific magical purpose.
But, like, so is that the hook? Or is it, you know, did someone die before they changed the law? Is the reason for that?
I think that's a good question. I think you can do it... Because legacy is the weirdest driver for anybody, great people always want to have a legacy. They want to have
name carved in stone.
Their blood continues on. And you know who's got quite a legacy, but is not someone's child?
Carl Sagan.
What? Okay. That was a real Kyle thing to do. No, Augustus.
Oh, yeah.
Dude is not Julius Caesar's child.
No, he is not.
And he is the fucking heir to that and did just as much.
Yeah.
Like, their legacies are like twins.
Yeah.
They both did a fuck ton. That's the kind of dynamic that you could actually have if you say, okay, well, Ciri's gone. I will write it. I will pick the best person that I can find to be my heir who shows ambition, right. Yada, yada, and then rewrite it. And right. I think, like, using the Caesar approach, you could come up with a really interesting story.
I agree.
Of almost a competition among the nobles, among great people in the capital, trying to position themselves because, oh, Ciri ran away, and maybe if we can impress Amir, he will just name me his heir and adopt me as his child.
But you have to prove you're capable.
Exactly.
And then you wind your way back almost into the plot of, I guess the reverse plot of Gladiator. Because Marcus Aurelius was trying to give Maximus, he wanted to make Maximus emperor instead of.
We don't make emperor. Boy. He wanted to make him like protector or whatever.
Yeah,
like, to like give power back to the Senate.
Yeah, it was. I forget what's not Cicero. What is Joaquin Phoenix's character's name? All I'm thinking of is Little Bitch Boy, which is not. Because he's actually an incredibly deadly person and capable character. He's just insane.
Oh my God, Little Bitch Boy is such a good name.
One moment later.
Who? Commodus.
Commodus, thank you. Or no, I guess he didn't, and Marcus Aurelius even got killed. Yeah, all right.
I'm just going to delete this section.
There are themes that are related. I think it's fine.
I think we lost it.
I think we should keep it in there. I think it's the best we've
ever done. I think it's mostly this is long.
No, that's fine. I think we should leave it in. I think it's the best we've ever done.
All right. What stuck for you?
Carl Sagan.
Okay. I feel like there's a theme coming up.
Probably the court witcher. I think that's fun. Or the court ranger, the court wildsman.
Yeah.
Because I think there are a couple ways you can play that. One, it does answer it. I think it is a good question. Who's in charge of the boundary? Who's in charge of keeping the territory safe, not just the who's actually out there manning it for you.
Yeah.
And then you get some really cool devices in there to play around with is, well, do they have to live in the city or are they actually out there navigating the territory and they're just sending back missives via raven or telepathy?
They just have like they have two ravens, one at the castle, one at the hut where the witcher lives, and they just send a message being like, okay, reports of X report, and then like killed X, you know, like,
yeah.
And they just kind of, yeah, they're just like an updates happening that way. And then they come to court, you know,
and you on get, occasion. And you get that Benjen Stark moment of, you know, the door, the,
yeah,
and like, oh, they're shit, they're fucking back.
But, and the king's like, hey, you're back. And he's like, yeah, good to see you. And they have a good rapport, but it's like, yeah, there's like it could be a fun reveal for everybody else, but then it'd be like, oh, you haven't met him yet, but like, he's been around forever and he's great.
Yeah.
And maybe he is a crotchety old asshole.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The point is that he exists.
Yeah.
And I think that's cool. I think that's a very cool idea. The other thing probably will be, again, it was a bit rambly, but the language thing I think is really important is, finding a way to make a world seem fantastical enough, but still intuitive and intelligible by the use of existing language, I think is really important.
Yeah, that was a rare instance where this podcast moved more into like how to, instead of a like a case study. But it's a useful acknowledgement, especially because I think you're right. Like, this is a world where the language is just at that right spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think it's the
Carl Sagan.
No. Yeah. it's Carl Sagan. No, it's the evolution of the Trial of the Grasses. I think it was that point about like, oh, what if they just improved it,
perfected it? Yeah, and that's really cool. Yeah,
and that like, oh yeah, this is just an ancient process. They haven't tried.
No one's looked at it in 1,000 years.
And the idea of any like in any world, like, you know, and this is a common thing in fantasy in particular, where you're just like, oh, well, this is just the ancient magic. It's like, has anyone ever tried to update the magic? We've talked about research here before. It's like, why don't you just do research on, can we do it better? And like having an initiation ritual like that, where just no one has even considered they could make it safer.
Yeah.
They just assume, well, that's the way it is. It's how it's gotta be. You're like, well, or not.
Well, it's a great, and here, let's take an example. It's a really cool way of thinking about why paladins exist. Because imagine you had a world where only clerics existed, and then suddenly figured out, wait a minute, I don't need to have it. You've been devoting yourself to a god this whole time. You don't have to do that. Just swear an oath.
To just an idea.
You don't need a god. You can have an idea and you get all this other cool shit.
Yeah. To be fair, they usually have gods too, but...
But they don't have to, is the point.
Yeah. It's an interesting analog, is that like you could evolve the way that these classes, for lack of a better term,
sure,
these
archetypes,
professions, you know, whatever it is in these fantasy worlds, like the way that they enter into it. It's like, why is no one evolving it? To your point about like the ranger evolving as an archetype to be like, is the modern ranger this? It's like, well, is the, you know, the modern warrior going to stop wearing armor? And be like, well, that's just cumbersome. Wear light padded armor and carry, you know, like lighter swords. But like, let's do away with the big burly knight because it's too cumbersome. Like that kind of thing. You can evolve it.
Because warfare is evolving. We don't use tanks in the same way that we did.
Yeah. We no longer use horses.
Right. Now we use drones. Is that going to change it will change warfare. But how will that be reflected in fantasy media specifically, is my point.
Carl Sagan,
exactly.
Yeah, well, that's what stuck for us.
Let us know what stuck for you.
Emails in the show notes.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.